From Washington, D.C., this is The Tightrope. I'm your host, Dan Smolin. Our mission on this podcast is to help you realize your dreams of doing meaningful work. Here, you'll meet and be inspired by amazing people who overcame great odds. You'll discover what sparked them, how they explored work opportunities, the strategies that they employed to ensure career success, and the actions that they boldly took to make it all happen. You'll also meet esteemed and nationally recognized thought leaders who are helping people like you to develop work skill, experience in leadership, and seize opportunity from a changing world so that your beautiful work dreams turn into reality. Together, let's turn work meaningful, for meaningful work is the future of work. Today on the Tightrope Podcast, we present another of our Between the Seasons episodes, during which we will take a step or two back from the style and format of our seasonal episodes, but also explain to you the why of what we do. We will get current with the issues that affect people in the workforce seeking meaningful work, but also to shine a light on the work that we do on the Tightrope Podcast to make your journey to meaningful work both rewarding and successful. Coming up, we go across the pond to chat with Russell White, a London-based executive recruiter with Premier Consultants and also a presenter with D-Light Radio. Russell provides interesting and meaningful perspectives on the search for professional talent, the UK's looming Brexit deadline, his pivot into radio as a disco presenter, and his advice to two famous people named Meghan and Harry, who are seeking meaningful work careers. But before we get into our interview with Russ, we want to thank you for being part of the Tightrope. We hope that you like the guests that we have featured and appreciate all the changes that we have made to our format that we hope will make your podcast experience a pleasurable yet informative one. One area where we could really use your help is in building our audience. If you enjoy the Tightrope, we ask that you tell five friends about us. They can subscribe to us by keywording The Tightrope with Dan Smolin wherever they get podcasts. Our best promotional vehicle is you, and we truly appreciate all that you do and continue to do to help us build our listenership. Thank you. We have reached the midpoint of January, and we hope that for you, 2020 has gotten off to a great start. But there's so much going on in the world. And with presidential impeachment, rampant fires in Australia, Brexit, and Megxit, it doesn't surprise us that one earth-shattering moment in American labor failed to get much attention. But earth-shattering it was. As 2020 starts, we mark the epochal moment when women assume the majority status in the American workforce. The implications of this are manifold and significant. The healthcare and education sectors helped put women in the majority of the workforce and will, in the years to come, extend it further. Among the greatest challenges for women at work are in securing career and compensation scale and paid family leave. Women make a fraction of what men make doing the same work. With more women than men in the workforce, market pressures will surely help to reduce the pay gap, but it won't be enough. New state and federal pay equity laws will be necessary to create true parity, and the fight for pay equity will be hard fought. Women need paid family leave more than men, but women also need contractual protection from their employers so that they won't lose a job due to a pregnancy. Women should not have to choose between work and starting a family, and in that respect, it is our hope that the American workforce gains family leave protections that resemble the ones in the European Union. Such changes cannot happen soon enough. Our challenge on the Tightrope Podcast is to help people find and do meaningful work. But we also hope to poke the bear, to get thought leaders in business, academia, and public service to rethink the role of work in society so that people doing it are productive, earn a good living, and most of all, live their dreams. So thank you for walking the tightrope with us in 2020 and in the years to follow. Please let us know what you think of our podcast. Offer up some story ideas and potential guests, or just say hello. Send us a tweet to @DanSmolin or pop us an email at info@dansmolin.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Here now, our conversation with London-based talent recruiter and radio presenter Russell White. We spoke to him in mid-January 2020 over Skype from his offices in London. So welcome to the tightrope, Russell White.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You are our first across the pond guest. Congratulations.
Well, I feel very honored to be so. Yes, definitely.
So you are a born and raised Londoner. When you were a little kid, what did you dream about being when you were all grown up?
Well, obviously from the age of five, I think I always wanted to be a train driver or a fireman. But I think that my sort of formative thinking in terms of career started probably around the age of 13. And I thought I thought I'd like to be a politician. And indeed for the first sort of few years, probably from the age of 14, probably to the age of about 16 or 17, I did start getting involved with politics. I joined what was then called the Young Conservatives in my constituency or my district. Right. That also happened to be the same constituency that, well, she wasn't then, but it was Margaret Thatcher. Right. Was our MP, who obviously then became eventually our Prime Minister, and used to go to debates and sort of hung out with those guys. Got quite involved, did a lot of work in when there was various elections. Met Margaret Thatcher's son. Obviously, had a lot met Margaret Thatcher on numerous occasions, basically. But then I kind of got bored with it, and I discovered. That I got involved with music, basically, and dancing. So I put that by the side. And then I joined McDonald's. At the time I joined their 10th ever store in the UK, and I worked there till about 1983, I think. And when I finished my degree, I did actually approach McDonald's about doing a full-time role either in their marketing department or within HR, and they basically offered me a store management role, and I didn't fancy that, so I left. And because I was actually excuse the pun, their first sandwich placement student. So for one year of my degree, I had to go and work in industry. I worked in McDonald's in their payroll department, and I became the assistant payroll supervisor for the whole of McDonald's, and by then there was probably about 50 or 60 stores. So I used to run the payroll for McDonald's. And then I think in 1983, I saw an ad in the newspaper saying, do you know anything about accountancy? And do you know anything about recruitment? And because my degree had been in, been around sort of personnel and training, I thought, well, hey, I could do that. I didn't know what a recruitment consultant was. I applied for the job, set my CV in, got an interview, eventually got the job, not really knowing what it was all about. They said, well, basically, and this is 1983 before computers.
Right.
And they said, well, here's a box of, here's a Rolodex of candidates. Here's a Rolodex of clients. Here's some jobs that people have rung in with us. Find the people who can do the jobs that you think are appropriate for the jobs. Phone them up and see if they're interested. So that's basically what I did. I thought, oh, credit controller. Yeah, now I'm looking for a credit controller. This person could do credit control. Rang the guy up and said, would you be interested in this job? And he went, yes, I would. Arranged the interview, and the guy got the job. And so I think in my first 3 months, I made about three or four placements and earned a bonus. And I thought, oh, this is quite easy and straightforward. I think I'll give this another 6 months. 35 years later, I'm still doing it.
Isn't that amazing? You know, your first, what I'm hearing from you is success came very quickly. It did for me too. I made my first placement at day 78. And I was like, wow, this is a thing. I could actually turn this into a career pivot. And I actually did for 20 years. So it sounds like you and I had the same quick ascension into the recruitment business.
Very much so, yeah. And it's always, and I think that it's very much about sort of understanding people. Obviously I've matured and got, and I think I've got, although the, I think recruitment has got more challenging over the years.
No, indeed.
It's become much more. It's easy to understand kind of what it's important to understand what people's motivations are. Why are they looking for a job? And I think that it's more about it's not about selling. It's about consulting now, because often sometimes you talk to people and actually you realize what you want to do is not necessarily say to them, well, here's a fantastic opportunity. You actually want to say to them, well, actually, I think what you should be doing is talking to your existing company and saying, you know, what opportunities I want to expand my horizons within. The business that they're already in,
right.
And I think that you have to get it's about getting the balance between obviously doing that where you don't earn any money and obviously making placements where you do earn money, really. And I think that there is it's about people. It's not about doing recruitment. It's not about ultimately for my benefit. It's for the benefit of the two parties that I'm working with, and I think that's a lesson I've learned over all the years I've actually been doing it.
Again, we're like kindred spirits here. It was for me, yeah, sure, I was making a great living doing it, but for me, it was that connection with people, and at the end of the day, making their lives better.
Very much so. And I think also from my perspective, Dan, I've always been interested in how businesses operate and their personalities and what their style, really. And what I particularly enjoy now is getting under the skin of a culture of an organization and then identifying people or individuals when I'm given a role, obviously to fill, that are on that sort of match that style, but equally are on a similar trajectory, career trajectory or otherwise, as that business. Because, you know, some businesses, they're steady eddy. They're not looking for, you know, massive growth. Other companies are sort of in spaces where, you know, they're not going to necessarily grow because the technology or the space that they're in, the demand is not increasing. It may well be decreasing. So you're always looking for those people that where you think that actually it's going to be a very, very, it's going to be a close match. And the sort of things that sort of I find very interesting is when I do place people and they're there for really long time, you know. So I think the longest anyone has ever stayed in a job that I placed them in, well, not the same job, they've actually moved up and became managing director, was about sort of 20 years. Placed someone sort of 20 years ago and as a kind of like doing database marketing or something like that, I think it was, became, MD of a, you know, pretty sizable publishing business here in the UK, and I think that's how I get my job satisfaction, because it's something I feel proud about. And I think the other thing I find I which kind of keeps me motivated is that, you know, I'm talking to this afternoon I'm talking to one of my clients, and this client was in fact the first person I ever placed in direct marketing in 1986, and 33 years ago, 34 years ago, my goodness. Mm-hmm. He's still my client and I still see him, and I've worked with him regularly over that whole period of time. So again, you know, it's that longevity and that sort of relationship experience that I've had during my whole career that I've got my satisfaction from.
You know, for our listeners, what Russell is articulating is what I've always tried to explain to past clients about the recruitment process. You know, we're not there to collect a fee in and of itself. We're there to make life better for you. And this process that you've just articulated is really what that's about. They have a problem. It may be that they have a talent deficit and they need to bring somebody in who can fix that problem. And this is where we came in. We knew people. We knew people. We knew what they could do. And it was our job to kind of divine the process. We have to ask really, really good questions. But we have to know a lot about the people we're putting in front of a client. So for those who think that recruitment is just an expensive thing, it's really a very necessary investment for some companies.
Absolutely. And one of my favorite sort of stock in trade sayings is when people say, well, what do you do? I sometimes say, I manage fate.
Wow.
Because at the end of the day, if I hadn't picked up the brief, and then I hadn't gone out to find the person, and that person happened to be in a mindset whereby they were thinking of perhaps moving on, or were attracted, or whatever reason, it's just really fate at the end of the day. You know, that's by bringing together these two people. I'm just a catalyst at the end of the day. I'd never force the match. I think that would be, I think that's disastrous, not just for the sort of the two parties involved, but also myself in terms of my reputation. You're there to sort of bring the parties together and see whether something happens at the end of the day. Obviously, you apply your knowledge and your skill sets and understanding and your intuition about people and what motivates them and their skill sets, etc. But it's very much around just bringing people together in a way that they both feel comfortable about, and that ultimately that they both benefit from.
Right. So we've talked about the three-legged table, the recruitment firm in the United States, Heidrick Struggles, articulated, which was, number one, can the person do the job? You or I would not be putting that person in front of a client if we felt or didn't know otherwise. Number two is, will they be excited about doing the job? And again, that's another thing that we would know. The third thing is what recruiters don't often have an entire handle on, and that is, at the end of 90 days, will we hate this person? And that's what I often call the fit check. How do you work towards getting somebody to fit within an organization, or at least have an understanding of whether or not they're going to align well with a culture or positively impact a culture?
I think you do that, Dan, right at the beginning of the process. As I say, if you know your clients and you know the culture and the style of the business, then you're looking for people who are effectively aligned or would work well or indeed thrive in that in that culture. You know, there are certain businesses which are which I would possibly classify as aggressive. They're very sales orientated. I think it would be inappropriate to mention any sort of names of businesses, but right. I've worked with some organizations where you just know in the way in their behavior patterns, especially with myself, for example, that actually this is kind of you need to be pretty headstrong and pretty robust yourself if you're going to survive and thrive in that type of culture or organization. Say for example in the agency sector, mm-hmm. Ad agency, CRM agency, whatever, again, you need to be a certain type of character, again, to work well. And that's usually someone who's very outgoing, confident, can hold their own in a conversation, can be very good at building relationships, good at sales, but equally has that understanding of whatever the service that the agency is providing. Mm-hmm. And again, just briefly talking about the agency side, you do have agencies which again are very aggressive, and others which are sort of very much more kind of consultative effectively, and it's about aligning those people's the personalities of the people with the personalities of the business. So when that 90 day moment actually comes, it sounds like you do, or you did what I used to do, what I do, which is kind of around that sort of that 3 month mark. I ring up the candidate and I say, how's it going? Or and I ask them how's it going. And usually when I ring them up, and I usually leave a voicemail because they're too busy or whatever, and I don't hear from them. And the reason why they don't want to speak to me is because I've done my job. They're very happy. I don't need you, kind of thing. So I'm never worried when people don't ring me back. It's when they do ring me back, that's when I do get worried, because it sometimes means things have not quite worked out as well as they had anticipated. Or indeed, they do sometimes ring you back and say, "Lovely to hear from you. It's going great now. Thanks very much. I'll call you if I need to hire anyone," sort of thing. So that's how I generally sort of manage it. I normally handle it sort of right from the outset, kind of thing, it happens right from the beginning.
I used to liken myself to Duff, this guy that was Tiger Woods' former caddy. You know, I'd be looking down the fairway and tell him, okay, this is how you got to play it. And I would do that with candidates, but also with clients. And I'll give you an example. I had one client at this was a great client. They were in the data services business, publicly traded company. And the hiring manager, who was a personal friend of mine, said, "I cannot screw this up." And I said, "I hear you. So let's talk about what that means." And what that meant was, I've got to make sure that anybody that you place in my organization has a really good shot at being retained. And what we came down to was this idea of understanding how somebody would operate in a dynamic situation. So we created, I know you did this too, situational dynamics, where we would create a scenario when the person was being interviewed. We would ask them, how would you handle this kind of a situation? So you get put into a group, and these are the kinds of personalities that you're with. Or you have a client and they call you at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday, screaming and yelling that they have to change the job spec for a certain active project. How would you handle it? And what was really interesting was that's where the truth came out. And not only was it truthful, it was actionable. It was information. If my client actually placed this individual in a role, they knew how to manage them. They knew how to be like Duff to Tiger Woods.
Mm.
I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, very interesting, because I had a real life situation happen indeed this morning, where I have a candidate. She's probably there right now, having her final interview. Got a phone call from the client at 9:15, saying the person that we want your candidate to meet. We didn't realize she only started yesterday, and doesn't work on a Tuesday, so we're going to have to cancel it. So I said to my client, that's not great. And the client was absolutely, I think he's very senior within the business. He said he really didn't know about it, he's very angry. And he said, "Well, look, see what you can do." And I said, "See what you can do." So anyway, I managed to catch the candidate. This is at 10 o'clock, the interview's at 11, at the train station. I said to her, I said, it's been cancelled. And I explained the reasons why. And the candidate was like, "Oh, I'm all." I said, "I know you are. I know how you feel. You know, I'm just as, you know, frustrated about this situation as you are." So, and I said, she said, "The train's coming in now." I said, "Don't get on it because there's no one to see you." So she let the train by, and then I'm talking to her about, you know, potential sort of, you know, rearranging for tomorrow or Thursday, and then I hear that someone else is calling in on my phone. It's my client. I said, right, it's my client. I'll call you straight back. Took the call, and then the client rings and says, "Well, actually, what we've done is we've got someone else very senior to meet the candidate, and we're going to get the head of HR, who doesn't come into the office on a Tuesday, to dial in. So she can still come at 11 o'clock." And I went, "Hold on." I went, "Okay, leave it with me." So I rang back the candidate and I said, "When's your next train from where you are coming into central London?" And she said, 8 minutes. I said, "Right, get on it." And I explained the situation. And the way in which the candidate actually handled that situation, because some people would blow up, you know, some people would say, you know, "This is outrageous. I don't want this. They don't know what they're doing, this company. They're disorganized, blah, blah, blah. You know, I had this situation before, blah, 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 blah." She went, "Fine, that's okay. I'll go." So, and she was very cool and sanguine about it. And so that just speaks volumes to me about her as a person. And I'll find out later on this afternoon whether she gets the job or not. Hopefully it will speak volumes about her to my clients as well. That, you know, okay, we mucked you about, you know, it was our fault, but you still came in and you came in cool, calm and collected. You made a great presentation. You handled the situation really well. The job is yours.
Okay, well, you provided the perfect segue to me because I wanted to talk about your role as a recruiter in the UK and more broadly in the EU. So this is mid-January 2020 as we record this interview, and Brexit is looming. My first question to you is, where is it right now? And my second question is to you, how is it going to affect you and your business?
Great question. So where Brexit is now, the UK is leaving the EU on the 31st of January. That will happen. So what that means is that the UK will no longer either contribute or take part in any of the elements like the Council of Europe, the European Commission, or indeed the EU Parliament. So all the MEPs, all the members of the UK members of the European Parliament, will no longer be able to. They're made redundant. Effectively, they're out. Mm-hmm. Effectively. Mm-hmm. We will leave those institutions. However, there will be what they're calling a year's transition, whereby the UK will still have will still be abiding by all the rules of the EU whilst during that transition period, whilst the UK and the EU negotiate what's called a final settlement. Mm-hmm. And basically the reason behind that is that it's not just about, well, it is obviously about trade and customs union, but equally things around sort of security arrangements, immigration. There's something in relation to, again, for example, about you know, all the rules and regulations about pharmaceuticals, about air traffic, about, you know, insurance, financial services, which is very important, obviously, to the UK. Mm. Movement of people from passport arrangements, etc. And that's all going to be negotiated in 12 months. The EU says it can't be done in 12 months. Our new government says it can be, and I kind of err towards what our government says, because again, just talking politics of the moment. I don't know whether any of this has resonated in the US at all, but the Parliament in Northern Ireland hasn't sat for 3 years because they've been at loggerheads for such a long time. Our new Prime Minister has come in, and basically in sort of a period of 6 to 9 weeks, they've sorted out their differences, they've negotiated a settlement, and the Parliament is sitting again, and they can get on with governing Northern Ireland. So you kind of think this man, our new Prime Minister, Mr. Johnson, seems to be able to get things done pretty quick. He seems to be a man in a hurry, basically. That's the view. So I think any impact sort of generally there won't be any real major impact at least for another 12 months. And my view is that I think that what will happen is that there's two types of Brexit. I don't know whether this resonates with your in the US, but there's a soft Brexit and a hard Brexit. A hard Brexit is we just leave everything and we'll just kind of throw everything up in the air and see where it lands and then renegotiate everything. Or there's a soft Brexit whereby they negotiate all those different elements, and there's a bit of horse trading in terms of different sort of what the EU wants from the UK and what the UK wants from the EU. And my view is that I think we'll probably have a softer Brexit than a harder Brexit, particularly around trade and alignment with a lot of EU regulations pertaining to standards of the provision of standards of goods and services.
So about 8 or 10 years ago, you and I partnered on a clean tech, clean energy type of placement. I had an American expatriate who you helped me place in Germany.
Yes.
How is that kind of a situation going to change? Are there going to now be barriers for you to do that? Or is it just we don't know or things will be different?
I think the short answer is we don't know. I think that a lot, because the relationships in terms of businesses in the UK and the EU are very strong, and because it's the EU, including the UK, is seen as, you know, one great big sort of geographical sort of, I don't want to use the word federal, but kind of, you know, there's a lot of commonality between the two between sort of the two groupings. I think that it won't have any impact. People will just go, do you know something, I want to use, you know, either myself or another recruiter to recruit a Brit for Berlin or Frankfurt or Paris or wherever it may be, actually. And I think that there'll still be that kind of sort of business relationship. Where I think there will be an impact, though, is on the movement of labour.
Right.
And you asked me what will be the impact. I personally think it will be a positive impact, because what it will mean is currently in terms of when you're looking to fill particular roles, you can go anywhere, you can find anyone in the EU. So, for example, 2 years ago, I was working with a very large multi-channel retailer for a very senior role in terms of e-commerce. And the person I found was an Italian who'd been working recently in China, had come back to Italy, was looking to come to the UK, and I got her the job, effectively. That won't be as straightforward moving forward because of the rules around immigration. She would have to then have applied for a work permit. She may not get it. So I think certainly in the short to medium term, what that will mean is that the labour pool in the UK will be sort of very UK centric, which means that you know, for certain roles, in particularly in some of the areas that I operate in, it will mean that there will be shortages. So consequently, you know, salaries will rise, and obviously our fees are related to are a percentage of people's salaries. So that will have an impact, and equally because recruiters generally have the network, or indeed if they don't have the network, they know where to go and look for people for specific roles, then I think that the market will return back in favor to recruitment consultants, because they understand the dynamics of both individuals and also of markets. So I actually see it as an bottom line is, Dan, I see it as an opportunity and a good opportunity.
Well, that's really interesting. And, you know, again, very, very interesting from a standpoint that, as you say, a lot of things you don't know how it's going to turn out. So stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Wednesday night here on Delight Radio. Good evening. And Happy New Year. First show of 2020 for me. First show of the decade. Thank you, Walter, for the last 3 hours. It's now me. It's Retro Russ. It's Discolicious. And that means late 70s disco.
I want to pivot now and talk about another dimension to your career, and that is as a radio presenter.
Yes.
You are a presenter for Delight Radio, which is on the internet. Is that true?
Yep, it's on the internet. It's actually we have. I don't know whether you have it in the US. We have digital DAB, digital audio broadcasting, which is kind of like FM, but much. But you can carry a lot more stations. The compression is much higher. It's, right. I won't bore you with the technical details. So it broadcasts in London, Manchester, Birmingham, Glasgow, and Portsmouth. So our potential catchment is sort of like 10, 15 million people. And yes, we're on the internet. We have an app. And although it should probably light up. If you ask Alexa. Yeah, she did light up, say play Delight Radio, then you can play Delight Radio.
Oh, interesting. So, yeah, we do have sub-channels here in the United States. Our terrestrial radio became digitized, I want to say, 10 or so years ago. So we do have sub-channels here in, especially in the Washington, D.C. area, where you can listen to alternate type programming, and it's lovely. It's wonderful. So, what's the origin story behind you becoming a radio presenter, and how did a teenage kid from the northern part of London discover American disco? That's what I really want to know.
Well, I think it all started from the age of about 16 or 17. So we're talking 1976, 1977. I'm showing my age here now.
Me too.
I was always into soul music. So, and that I can't remember how that came, how I sort of hooked onto that as opposed to rock or the other genres that were around at that particular time. I'm not saying I didn't like rock. I'm still a big, very, I always loved Queen, for example, and saw them many times in the 80s in concert. For me, I always loved soul, and I also like dancing as well. Mm. So I used to go to these various nightclubs, local youth clubs, and then obviously being in North London, all the sort of the West End clubs in central London. And that's where I really kind of began to really take an appreciation of the music. And from that age, sort of 16 or 17, it was earlier than that, from the age of 14, but I didn't go clubbing because I was too young. I just used to buy the records and just built up a collection. And then I think it must have been around 1982, 83, maybe 84 even. I bumped into, in a bar in London, the DJ that used to do all the major clubs. I said, oh, I remember you used to do that. Yeah, hello. He says, he said, do you want to buy my records? And because I'm moving to Spain. And I went, yeah. Okay.
Oh my God.
And I bought, literally, I bought thousands. And he, and I won't tell you the price because I think that would be that it wasn't so expensive. Put it like that. So I literally went to his flat, his flat where he lived in, again in central London. Two trips in my car, the suspension sort of right down on the floor, driving all these, picking up all these records, taking them all back to my to my flat, and that was real. And then I had all the records, played them all. I thought, great, I've got this collection. Loved all the music. Obviously, it was all the music from sort of earlier. And then I think about sort of 5 years. It was about 5 years later. I thought, do you know, I should do something with these records. So I bought myself a couple of record decks and a sort of a very basic kind of DJ sort of things. And I mm-hmm. and then people asked me, well, can you come and DJ at my parties? And I went, yeah, sure. So I said, DJ to play all my disco music. And I still kept buying, went to secondhand record shops, still kept buying the records, increased my collection. Just sort of where I live locally, I suppose 96, 97. I can't remember the exact date, Stan. You know, it's all, around 20 years ago, let's say. The guy in the pub said, I'm looking for someone to come and DJ on a Friday night. And he mentioned it to me. I said, well, I do DJ. I've got some equipment. And he said, well, come on. Well, why don't you come? Why don't you do it? I said, okay. So I started doing this DJing on a Friday night in the pub, and it got busier and busier and busier because no one at that time was playing disco music in London.
No, I would think not.
So I was playing this disco music, and it was getting busy, and the word was getting around, and all these people used to come in and they used to come. I used to play a particular record, and they used to come up to me, what's that record that you just played? And I said, well, it's this one. And they used to write it down. They said, oh, thanks very much. And then someone else would come up, what's that record? Never heard that one before. And basically, they were house music producers that were listening to what I was playing, and then going away, and then taking sort of samples from those records, sort of finding the record or finding it online or whatever. We were just about online dial up. At that time, or finding the record and then recreating the record with them with a more modern house beat. The guy I used to hire equipment from had a very the internet started, and broadband had just kicked in, and he'd had a pirate radio station, but he didn't want to do pirate, so pirate on the FM. He said, I'm going to do an internet radio station, do you want to come and join me to come and do a show? And I went, sure, you know, be a bit of fun. I've never done it before. That's where that kicked off. And then he kind of closed it down. He wasn't doing it anymore. So I found another station with some guys in Essex, which is just county to the east of London. And there was a very big soul scene in Essex. And I got hooked up with all the whole of that, what was called then the Essex soul scene. I then started doing more sort of DJing in and around London. So I started getting asked to play, can you bring your records and play here? Can you bring your records and play there? I started doing all those sorts of things. And it kind of kicked off from there. And Delight Radio is associated with another station called London Greek Radio, which is a community-based radio station broadcasting mainly in London, but it's also in Birmingham as well. And the person that used to run that is sadly no longer with us. Basically said, I'm starting a new radio station called Crackers Radio, and there used to be a club called Crackers in London where this music used to be played back in the late 70s, and we think we can build something. Would you like to come on there and play your disco records? And I went, of course I will. And to cut long story short, he moved on from his own station. He had he went and did something else. And the people that took over Crackers and LGR basically rebranded Crackers to Delight Radio, and I guess for want of a better expression, made it more I don't want to use the word professional because that's derogatory to what Crackers was, but I think just sort of sharpened it up, basically. I stayed. Some people, Crackers Radio basically then went off and restarted elsewhere, but I stayed with Delight, and it's kind of grown from there, really. So thoroughly enjoy it. It's my hobby. You know, people say, well, why do you do radio? And I said, well, some people go as their hobby, go and play golf, or they go and play tennis, or they play squash, or go running. Well, my thing is I go on every Wednesday night, go and play disco music on a national radio station.
You know, it's amazing the intersectionality between our two experiences. I started in radio 40 years ago.
Wow.
And that was my first career act. I thought I was going to be on radio. I loved radio. I love the intimacy of it.
Likewise. Absolutely.
It's just amazing to me that, like me, you're still in it. I mean, I'm not on the radio. I'm a podcaster now. But it really fulfills the same kind of need that I had to communicate and have an intimate experience with my listeners.
Absolutely. That's what I really enjoy is that interaction, and knowing that you're sort of introducing what I would call old new music to different audiences. I know that it's global. I have people listening in. I have a lot of listeners in the US. But also right across Europe as well. And some of those are people who grew up in the same era that I did. But equally, there are people who didn't grow up in that era who kind of really find the music really resonates with them, that disco music. And I understand why. I mean, I love disco. It's kind of, it's what I play. But I listen to absolutely everything, Dan, and occasionally I get to present other shows on when other presenters are absent or on holiday, etc. And I play other music, and it's very much around sort of playing what I'm feeling at that precise moment in time. Obviously, you play within certain you've got certain strictures that you have to play certain tracks. You have to play certain tracks, but that's fine. But it's about sort of conveying the emotion that I'm feeling about a particular track. And getting that sort of, okay, you're talking to a microphone, but you know that there are people listening and that they are actually, that they're actually enjoying the experience. You're giving enjoyment. And again, it's about giving back. And I know that certain other people play music and they won't mention the name of the track because it's kind of secret and, you know, it's a fantastic piece of music and it's, you know, I found it and I'm not going to share it with anyone else. Whereas my view is that you need to know who made that record in 1977 and what label it went on and who they worked with and who produced it. And because that person produced not only that track, but they also produced this one, which you will know about. So I think it's very much about sort of educating people towards, you know, this whole music. And then at the same time, sort of conveying my experiences that I had as a teenager going to the nightclubs in central London where this music was played because it was the kind of disco and dance because that's what they played in obviously in the clubs back in the day then and saying what it was like because you know all that's left is the music. You cannot convey the atmosphere over the radio of what those clubs were like. I think if I want to give an example to your listeners, I'm sure a lot of people, you know, they'll all be familiar with Studio 54 or the Trocadero in San Francisco. The club, a few of the clubs in London were very similar to that kind of atmosphere, that kind of hedonistic attitude that they had at that time, which I try and put across, but it's not always easy to do that.
Started the show with a little Cool in the Gang. Funky stuff and more funky stuff. And this is GQ. Boogie, oogie, oogie. that what you say with me all the way through till midnight?
So I want to pivot to my final set of questions, which have to do with my new playground of meaningful work, which is I describe as work that is profound, often protects the planet, empowers people and communities, and is fun to do. When I was still recruiting, you know, I think like you, I would dig into what motivates people that I was looking to place into work, what got them out of bed in the morning. And oftentimes it was the big ones, probably because I placed a lot of sales and marketing people, was money and success. I guess my question to you, Russ, is have you noticed over the years a change in what motivates people to do work that they want to do?
Yes. I think that people are more more choosy in terms of the types of organizations that they want to work for. They, you know, for example, anything that, you know, may be construed as, excuse me, as unethical or something that is slightly untoward, people prefer to steer away from those types of companies or industries. I also think that people look for organizations where there is a lot of kind of where they look after their staff. And by that, what I mean is not just kind of like health benefits or you know, pension or anything like that, but you know, there is a sort of an element of understanding around well-being and kind of care. Now, obviously, legislation has played a part in that, in the sense that, you know, certainly in the UK and indeed Europe, you know, there's lots of things around sort of maternity leave, paternity leave, benefits, time off, things like that. But equally, a lot of companies now talk about things like, you know, sabbaticals. I've picked up briefs from organizations whereby, you know, once you've been employed for a specific period of time, you can actually take a 3-month sabbatical to go and work, to go and volunteer somewhere for a charity or something a little bit more sort of humanistic, I guess. And then you can have things like one of the key things that seems to be, which is more important, is people like to work from home.
Yes.
And again, what I find is that people are look for roles where there are those sorts of opportunities, and equally where companies are willing to allow people to actually work from home. So again, these are things that are I think are important, and it's about quality of life, I guess. You know, in the UK, if you're working in central London, it's very difficult. Well, it's challenging, I should say, commuting into central London every day, because our transport infrastructure it's okay, but it's crowded. A lot of people that live in the southeast of England, and coming into central London is a bind. It's stressful. So if there is the opportunity for people to work from home, then people look for that.
I remember when we saw each other last year, I was staying in a borough called Clerkenwell, and it was what, 3 tube stops away from where you were, I think, at the time. And I was like, oh, this is easy. And you looked at me and you went, no, Dan, most people come from farther the way than this.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely.
So in the quest for meaningful work, I'm aware of one couple that very public facing. He, a former military man, and she, a former star of stage and screen. They go by Meghan and Harry.
Oh, yes.
What advice would you give this young couple for their reboot into doing meaningful work and having a meaningful life?
As I'm sure you can imagine, as I'm sure your listeners can imagine, this is the number one topic that is dominating every single talk radio show, every news bulletin, every newspaper, and the conversations around the place, effectively. So I take the view that let them get on with it, whatever they want to do, really. And I think that if they want to be do something, give back to the planet, and focus on the issues that they are interested in, then good luck to them. And if they can do good, then more power to their elbow, I say. I think the Queen, it was announced today that they, again, I don't know whether it's been picked up in the US at all, but the Queen had a meeting with Harry, William, and Prince Charles, where they sort of sat around a table in her house, well, mansion. Yeah. It's not really a palace, in Sandringham, which is to the east of England, in the long room for 90 minutes. And an hour after the meeting, she issued a statement where she basically, it was pretty, for the Queen, it was pretty a pretty informal statement. And she accepts, she basically said, let them get on with it. Effectively, obviously, there's going to be a transition period whereby he moves away from being a full-time royal into doing the things that they want to do. But we let them do what they want to do. And as I say, to both of them, good luck to both of them. And I would say to your listeners that I actually feel sorry for Meghan, because I think she's been vilified in the press, in the particularly in the UK, and I think it's been a. I can understand why they've had to, why they've made this decision. Harry's mother was Princess Diana, and we all know what happened in and her relationship with the press. I think it's had a major impact in terms of his mental health, as he's pointed out. And I think he's been really brave to bring that up, you know, that old sort of British stiff upper lip. That seems to have gone by the wayside, which I think is no bad thing. And I think that if they can both do good, both, you know, on a global basis, they will effectively enhance the brand of the royalty, and at the same time do good for people around the world as well. I think they'll end up living in Canada, which is part of the British Commonwealth anyway. Who knows, he might become Governor General, so effectively head of state in Canada. Who knows? But I'd say I wish them well. And as long as they have a happy and fulfilling life with their son Archie and their three dogs, I say good luck. I wish them well.
All kidding and Richard Quest growling aside, I think that they're going to be a model for doing meaningful work. I agree with you on that front, and good on them. And I think a lot of our listeners will wish them well. One last question to you, Russ, to somebody hearing this podcast episode who is seeking meaningful work. How would you guide them across the tightrope to doing the work of their dreams?
Wow. Good question. I think that opportunity, if you don't ask, you don't get.
Right.
That's always been my sort of my philosophy. And if there is a particular area or avenue that someone may wish to explore or pursue, then it does absolutely no harm in having a go. And identifying the people that may be able to help you in doing that. Look for influencers in that area. Reach out to those people. Obviously, at the same time, educate yourself about the requirements to fulfill whatever role or opportunity that you're interested in doing, and keep learning. That's the important thing. Just keep learning, keep understanding, keep abreast of situations in that in that particular field. Just be knowledgeable, and be open, and at the same time be sanguine about a situation. I see my role very much around manipulating fate. At the end of the day, what you end up doing is down to fate. You know, there's an element of skill and driving yourself in a particular direction. But if you don't make the interview at a particular time, or you don't meet someone, something, or you miss a job ad that been advertised on a particular job board or whatever, you've missed it. But if you see it and you go, oh, that's interesting, that's fate. You know, you've seen it. You've done something about it. You've applied. And then off you go. I think I'm very fatalistic about life. You know, what I always say, what will be, will be. You know, so, but you, as I say, you, I think people have the opportunity, not just myself, but everyone has the opportunity to manipulate fate for their own advantage and for their own personal gain and for their own personal well-being and for their own happiness.
That is some brilliant insight from across the pond. Russell White, thank you so much for walking the tightrope. If our listeners want to learn more about you or about your presenter role on D-Lite Radio, how would they find you?
Okay, so if I give you a load of information, if you want to find out about my company, if you go to allthews.premcons.com, that's P-R-E-M for mother, C-O-N for November, S for sugar.com. That's my recruitment business. For Delight Radio, it's all the W's. Delight, spelt D-E-L-I-T-E, radio.com. You can find out there's bios on both those sites about my radio and my and obviously my professional work. Clearly I'm on Facebook, so that's facebook.com/ Retro Russ, which is my DJ moniker name. Maybe another time I'll tell you how I got that name. I think I'm also on Instagram, on Twitter as Russell_Premier. If you want to contact me directly, then it's Russell with two L's at premcons.com. Or if you want to contact me from a music perspective, it's retrorus@hotmail.com.
Well, thank you so much for being on the tightrope.
Thank you, Dan.
Our thanks go out to Russell White for walking the tightrope with us. Links to his social media are included in the show notes for this episode. On the tightrope, our success is your success, but we cannot build our community without your help and support. So, if you haven't already, please join the Dan Smullen Experience to get our newsletter offering information, tips, and hacks to help you to succeed in doing meaningful work. To sign up, simply click the Subscribe to the Dan Smullen Experience newsletter button on our homepage at dansmullen.com. Fill out the short form, then click the Subscribe button at the bottom of the page, and you'll be on your way. Also, become a regular listener of the Tightrope with Dan Smullen podcast. You can easily find current and past episodes by keywording the Tightrope podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can listen to us on our website at dansmullen.com. And please show your support on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. You can locate our social media buttons at the upper right corner of our webpages at dansmullen.com. From Washington, D.C., this is The Tightrope. I'm your host, Dan Smullen. And do remember this, our best days lie ahead. Have a great and successful week, everyone.